Deadly heat waves are a new fact of life in a warming world, and cities are even hotter than the surrounding countryside. We did not know that urban heat island effect becomes more extreme as the planet moves to 2 degrees and hotter. It is another unpleasant surprise. Here to untangle all that is Dr. Sarah Burke. After a time in finance, Sarah began a serious study of the urban heat island effect in the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Now she's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of North Carolina Data-Driven Lab. Sarah is lead author of the new PNAS paper, Amplified Warming in Tropical and Subtropical Cities Under 2 Degrees C Climate Change. From Chapel Hill, Sarah Burke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
The fact that cities get hotter than the surrounding countryside, that's been known since the British climatologist Gordon Manley first described it in 1958. Now we realize even that will change as the climate warms up?
Yeah, so actually this, the urban heat island effect, it was the first time that humans realized that they were impacting the local climate. So it's something that we've known about for a long time, but it's kind of driven by different climates. So if you're in an arid climate versus a really humid climate, the magnitude of the heat island might be different. So it kind of follows that if this is something which is influenced by climate, if the climate is changing, then the magnitude of this heat island could also change in the future.
Well, I don't know. I thought they could just sort of move in lockstep so that if it's 1 degree warmer, let's say, in the whole part of the Carolinas, then the cities will just be 1 degree hotter. But it doesn't work like that.
The urban heat island is essentially kind of a relative effect. So it's a product of both the urban environment and also the rural environment. So something that we're seeing in the future is actually that climate changes can have an impact on the rural surroundings of a city. So if we're looking at the impact of 2 degrees warming on a rural area, that might lead to vegetation changes. So if there's less or more vegetation in an area, that can amplify the difference between the urban and rural areas. So vegetation versus concrete have very different interactions with the climate. So if one of those areas is changing, then the temperature in that area will change in a different way.
Well, yes, why are cities hotter? Is it just the mass of concrete and asphalt, or is there more to it? What are the various mechanisms that make us hotter in the cities?
There's a few different reasons for it. So exactly what you're saying, there's differences in thermal properties. So concrete can heat up very quickly and then dissipate that heat very quickly to the surrounding air, whereas grass and kind of like surfaces with a lot of water retention, it can take them a really long time to heat up. So an example of that would be the ocean. So it can store a lot of heat without its temperature increasing as much. But in cities, concrete heats up really quickly, and then at the night time that heat just radiates out and warms the air. Also, this might be getting a bit too technical, but an important aspect is also the way the heat is transferred. So in rural areas, you typically have a lot of water retention, so a lot of moisture. And when solar radiation heats up an area, the change of state from a liquid to a gas actually takes in a lot of energy without increasing the temperature of that area. So in a rural area, you have a lot of that type of heating, which is called latent heating. The solar radiation shining on that area will not actually increase the temperature as much because it's evaporating water. But in a city, there's very little water retention. So all of that heat from the sun is going into actually heating up the temperature of city surfaces. And then you also have buildings, so those can limit ventilation because wind is not able to kind of dissipate the heat. And you have internal heat sources as well, so buildings given a lot of heat was the HVAC systems, and then vehicles as well. They're also letting a lot of heat out. So there's many kind of different factors which lead to urban areas being warmer than their rural surroundings.
Well, just to nail this down, let's take a case like Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a subtropical city with 500,000 people, I think. And in 2021, a community group measured the difference between downtown Raleigh and the countryside, and they found an amazing 9 degrees Fahrenheit or 5 degrees C extra heat in town. So if the global mean average goes 1 degree, say, hotter than it is right now, how would that city-to-country difference change?
Something that we were looking at in the paper was changes in the land surface temperature rather than air temperature. But if the rural land surface temperature of an area was to increase by 1 degree Celsius, something that we saw in many cities was the additional warming in the city was from 0.5 degree to 1 degree Celsius warmer. So the total change in the urban area would actually be 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warmer, whereas the rural area would just increase by a single degree. And that's kind of very city or area specific, so it would kind of depend on the type of climate that the city was located in. So in particular, we saw that the cities in monsoon regions, these are the cities where the urban warming is a lot faster than the warming in the surrounding area.
Before your new study, we did have studies of the urban heat effect in megacities like Tokyo or New York. Why did mid-sized cities get left out, and does that really matter?
Many studies focus on those megacities because they are important. There are a lot of people who live in those areas, and you would expect them to have a very large heat island. But we kind of really wanted to fill the research gap of these medium-sized cities because there's not a lot of other studies looking at them. And these previous studies actually find that in London, for example, the urban heat island actually saturates. So it kind of rapidly increases with urbanization, but then there hasn't been much of an increase in the past few years in its magnitude. So it might be that medium-sized cities and megacities actually kind of have different properties in their heat island. We also felt it was important to look at these smaller cities because currently the grid cells in global Earth system models or climate models, they're very coarse. So they might kind of capture the scale of a megacity, but a small or medium-sized city is going to be very much kind of lost in that grid cell in comparison to the more rural surroundings such as grassland or forest or desert, for example.
It would be handy if we ended up with a map or a database where we could look up our own city and see whether we are already as hot as we're likely to get, or at least the difference between city and country is as hot as it might be that saturated point, or whether we have more to come and should prepare for that.
I think that for climate adaptation and human health and comfort in the future, it's really important for us to focus on the most vulnerable populations, and because people in cities are already experiencing these higher temperatures, it's kind of really important for us to know exactly how they're going to be impacted and where we should put these adaptations to protect people.
We'll be right back with Sarah Burke.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The urban heat island effect is increasing. From the University of North Carolina, we go back to Dr. Sarah Burke. Looking at your map in the paper, it looks like cities in the northern hemisphere get even hotter, but some cities, mid-sized ones, in the south, in South America and Africa, see almost no increase of the urban heat island effects during warming. What are the factors behind that, Sarah Burke?
So, yeah, we do see that in our research that some of the cities in Brazil, the heat island is actually slightly decreasing in the future. this isn't necessarily meaning that those cities aren't going to experience warmer temperatures, and they most likely will because their rural areas is increasing. So we are seeing increases in the urban areas. But in these areas, the climate model projections show that there's decreasing amounts of vegetation and kind of climate changes within the rural areas. So what that means is that those rural areas are becoming more similar in temperature to the urban areas. Because this is a relative measure, it just means that the rural areas are getting hotter and the urban areas are not getting hot at quite the same.
Many cities only report temperature at the airport, likely outside the urban core, which may be hotter. And you talked about getting ground temperatures. How did your team detect actual urban heat for this research?
We actually were using satellite-sensed land surface temperature for the exact reason that you described. So a lot of these urban weather stations are actually located outside the city boundaries at airports. And one of the reasons for this was actually because when this heat island effect was discovered, a lot of researchers realized that they were picking up on this kind of false warming signal in the air temperature measurements because they were actually picking up on the signal of urbanization. So that led them to relocate their weather stations to outside of the city areas. Actually, this is something that in my current role, we've been doing a lot of research to kind of find ways to address this, also using machine learning approaches. But a good proxy of air temperature is land surface temperature, which you can observe using satellites. So we use the satellite data from a NASA satellite called AQUA. And we also, in this research, actually excluded cities which were coastal and in mountainous regions. And in these areas, the kind of differences between land surface temperature and air temperature are the hardest to kind of quantify. But in the cities where we looked at the land surface temperature, there's kind of a stronger relationship between air temperature and land surface temperature. So we kind of aim to make our study a lot more applicable to humans in that way.
Your primary research results are based on projected temperatures at 1:30 in the afternoon. And doctors I speak with say when it comes to mortality, nighttime lows are actually as critical as daytime highs. Did you include nighttime highs, and are those expected to change in medium-sized cities if we get to 2 degrees C of warming?
Yeah, nighttime temperatures are really important because we kind of need that time to sleep and recover from the heat of the day. They really are something that is important to look at. We kind of focused on the daytime temperatures for this study, but I completely agree that, nighttime temperatures are really important for human health.
Talk to us about what your new study means for hundreds of millions of people in mid-sized cities in India and Pakistan.
Yeah, I think that this is really of relevance to policymakers. So I think it just underscores the importance of having key action plans or really thinking about how these cities can be adapted for people to be able to escape from extreme heat. So whether this means increasing green space in cities or maybe shading structures, potentially retrofitting homes so they have better insulation and they don't get as hot, it really opens the door for targeted mitigation and really focusing on areas in cities where already the temperatures are very high.
Quoting from your paper, it says, in 2018, it was estimated that over half the world's population resided in cities, and this proportion is projected to increase to 68% by 2050, end quote. So it could be even worse with higher heat mortality. Did your study manage to include expansion of cities in the coming decades?
This is something that we didn't look at was the urban expansion. It's quite challenging to predict how cities might expand in the future because kind of you have to have an understanding of where they can expand into. But certainly the cities that we looked at, which are medium-sized cities, it's very likely that they will expand in size.
What is the data-driven lab at UNC?
So the data-driven lab at UNC is a team of researchers who focus on applying data-driven solutions to environmental problems.
Okay, could you give us an example of a project that you do there?
Yeah, so the current project that I'm working on is a NASA-funded project which looks at exploring disparities and solutions to heat stress in U.S. cities. So part of that involves on-the-ground measurements. Like you mentioned previously, we have a lack of these human-centric observations in cities, so air temperature and humidity measurements within cities. So we're kind of working to address that problem both by collecting data but also combining it with remote sensing data and LIDAR data in order to build continuous maps of air temperature.
You know, I see this new paper as part of a new trend in science. In the early stages of climate study, with less computing power, the best we could do was global trends and very large grids. And now scientists are able to include regional predictions and even specific forecasts, and it's closer to the reality of where we live. Do you see that as a sort of new trend, a new focus in science?
Yes. Exactly. I see that, in particular, new research involving machine learning techniques, for example, can really speed up these very computationally heavy processes. So that's also an advance. But yeah, these climate models, they have to kind of split the entire globe, not just horizontally, but also vertically into grid boxes, and then they run for decades into the future. So that's very computationally expensive, but with computational resources improving and also machine learning, which can kind of reduce the computational expense of these models, I feel like, yeah, we're getting to be able to run more different scenarios and look at different cases.
Do you see a difference in science in using machine learning versus, say, artificial intelligence? Are they the same thing or are they different?
In my experience, I would say that machine learning is kind of falls under the umbrella of artificial intelligence. But the type of machine learning model that we would use is we kind of aim to use models which are interpretable and driven by physical processes that we know are true, so we can make sure that they're kind of behaving in the way that we want them to. And we kind of aim to use models which really aren't too black box, and we can really understand what's happening with them. But I'm not super familiar with some of the artificial intelligence methods, such as large language models like ChatGPT. It's not something that I use, but I feel like they, in my mind, are different types of techniques.
I would agree. You've got a torrent of information coming down from satellites, and it's more than any human can grasp. So you run that through a machine and say, what are we looking at? Whereas artificial intelligence with large language, yeah, you're asking it to be the researcher, and I don't think we're doing that. From the University of North Carolina Data-Driven Lab, we've been speaking with postdoctoral researcher Sarah Burke. She is lead author of the new PNAS paper, Amplified Warming in Tropical and Subtropical Cities Under 2 Degrees C Climate Change. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sarah, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.